In today's gospel, Jesus says, "Call no one your father on earth, for you have one father, the one in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant. All who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all who humble themselves will be exalted." An appropriate teaching, I think, for this Sunday where we both celebrate and read the ordinary lectionary readings and acknowledge All Saints celebration, All Saints Sunday. And the most powerful way that we do that is that just before the Eucharist, I read the necrology, which is the list of all those in our extended family who have died in the last year. This year we have 32 names that I will be reading aloud, and among them are people whose funeral we had here: Diana, Paul, Susan, Jay, Tim, and Jimmy. On this Sunday, we remember all the saints. So who are they? Who are all the saints? Well, people come to mind immediately: Saint Paul, Saint Francis, Saint Teresa, and so on. So we know that they're saints. But then there are ordinary saints too. I hope you know the Victorian song, "I Sing a Song of the Saints of God." God helping to be one too. The idea is that we are all invited to be saints, and I hope that you have at least a few people in your life that you confidently can say are saints or have been saints to you. When we're thinking about who the saints are and whether we might be one too, there's good news, bad news, and then there's good news again. The good news is that Jesus today, in today's gospel reading, gives a very clear sense of who might be a saint. It's those, he says, who understand that their Father is not here on earth, but that their true Father is in heaven. And it's one who doesn't look to any ordinary teachers as their teacher, capital T, but look only to the Messiah. So there we have two qualifications. And then the third is one that's a very practical one. Saints are the ones who are the servants of others, who are truly humble, that don't exalt themselves, but instead exalt God. So Jesus here gives us a very clear sense of who a saint is. That's the good news. The bad news is that I would venture that each one of us here in this church this morning is not perfectly any of those things. We don't always view that our true Father is the Father in heaven. We don't always look to Jesus as our only teacher and our only Messiah. And all of us, to some degree or another, like to puff ourselves up a little bit, at least internally, and exalt ourselves rather than exalting God. So, if we're being honest with ourselves, none of us is a perfect saint. That's the bad news. Now, here's the good news, and there's actually two elements to this piece of good news. The good news is that all of us already are forgiven for all of those flaws. When Jesus died on the cross, he died on the cross for all of us, wiping out those sins. And it is never too late to make a start or to make a new start in training in righteousness, in becoming the one that we are supposed to be, in becoming the saint that God intends for us to be. So the good news is we can start again right now in our effort to become a saint, in our ability to grasp God's grace and become a saint. That's part of the good news. The other part of the good news, at least for me, is that unlike most Protestants, but like many Roman Catholics and Orthodox and Anglicans typically are falling somewhere in between, I believe in purgatory. It's not a necessary belief. If you're a strict Protestant, you might say that wherever you're going to end up happens right at the moment of your death. Now, purgatory, as you may know, is a kind of in-between place. Now, purgatory in the popular imagination very often has a bad reputation. It's like a place of punishment, some sort of torture chamber before you get to enter into the glory of heaven. But I don't view it that way. I believe, with my whole heart, that God refuses to be embraced with a lie or any other of those sort of moral impurities that we carry in our soul, even, I believe, beyond death. And so the process of purgatory, that place, is a place where our souls can be, well, where in our souls we are invited to release all of those things that have held us back from fully understanding and knowing and inhabiting love, God's love, in our earthly life. We have a chance, again, to make progress and to go and be face to face with God. I believe that our souls and who we are continues like on a kind of trajectory on the other side of the grave, and that if it is in our heart to love God and to love God completely, that trajectory continues for a time as we are cleansed of all of those impurities so that we can finally be with God and embrace God and see God, as I said, face to face. I'm not alone in believing this. In our spiritual forum, we just concluded reading aloud the entirety of C.S. Lewis's short book, The Great Divorce, which is a beautiful picture of purgatory. And in this picture, it's a kind of landscape, and souls that have been in a place that is hell or like hell come up into this landscape and are given the opportunity by glowing spirits to go deeper and deeper into the landscape towards God. And time and again, those spirits who have that opportunity choose to stay in control, as they come to understand it, to hold on to their way of being, their understanding of what it means to be good. They don't want to let go and go into God. There's, in fact, only one figure of all of the different souls that appear there who ultimately decides, and it's an anguished choice, to let go of his particular sin, which happened to be lust. And in the moment that he lets it go, C.S. Lewis portrays him as hopping on top of a powerful stallion who then charges in the direction of where God is going to be. That's what the cleansing is like, according to C.S. Lewis, and I believe that that's something like what the truth is. That's half of the good news about purgatory, and that's something I learned from C.S. Lewis. I learned another piece about purgatory from Dante. In the Divine Comedy, the middle part of the Divine Comedy, it's, you know, it's the Inferno, Purgatory, and then the Paradiso, which is heaven. Purgatory is a mountain that Dante travels up with his guide, Virgil. And one of the things that he discovers is that the souls making their way up that mountain have an accelerated process if those who have loved them on earth are praying for them. That our prayers make a difference for the progress of the souls through purgatory towards God. I believe that, and I practice it as though I believe it, which means that of the 6 or 7 people whose funerals I did this year, I prayed for them and I continue to pray for them that they might be embraced more and more by the love of God. And as I read aloud the 32 names of the people, I invite you to enter into that practice with me, to pray for the repose of their souls, which is the old language for praying for those who have died. Pray for those who have died whom you have loved. Part of my practice every week is to pray for my grandparents, very specifically to call them to mind and ask that particularly there's one who was a particularly difficult human being, and I pray for him in particular that he might be embraced ever deeper into the mystery of God. Is that the way it actually works after death? I don't know, and nobody else does either. But it is a beautiful practice, and it may very well be true. And if nothing else, praying for those who have died strengthens the communion of all of the saints in heaven, the saints in purgatory, and the saints here on earth. Amen.